Good morning.
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 My name is Kokyo. I come from down the hill on that side, Santa Cruz Zen Center, a sister temple of Jikoji, where it rarely snows. It's probably people sunbathing on the beach today. So this is very beautiful to come up here and see winter really fully manifesting. And before we get started, maybe we can just go around and hear everyone's name. I might not remember it all, but...
Elizabeth.
Fred.
Jerome.
Judy.
Elijah.
Victor.
Simba.
Gil.
Cliff.
Dogen Zenji are medieval Japanese founder said in one of his most well-known sayings that many of you have heard, that to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be actualized by everything. And I would agree that the central issue of Buddha Dharma, we could say it in many ways, but we can say it in this way, that the central issue of Buddha Dharma is the investigation and clarification of the self. Who is this? Not only Buddha Dharma, but all spiritual traditions, whether they say it explicitly or implicitly, seems to be an essential element. To investigate, study, and clarify what is the self, and as Dogen says, to investigate and clarify, study the self, is to forget the self. So one of the most important teachings of the Buddha, radical, innovative teaching of the Buddha, and again, many people have heard this over and over. I don't know people's background. Maybe you're just checking out Buddhism. Probably people know some, and probably people have heard this teaching of no independent self, one of the Buddha's main important teachings. And whether we've heard it again and again or we haven't heard this, still, it's a very easily misunderstood teaching. And even if we feel like we really understand it, what does it mean to take it up completely and live our life based on this understanding? So to go into this a little bit. In the Buddha's time, there was this prevalent teaching in India of the Atman in Sanskrit, which is like a... It's like who we truly are is this, at our core, is this essential, invisible, abiding self that doesn't come and go. And is actually the source of all our activities of coming and going. And to discover that and unite with that, be that true self, is like the goal of the practice before Buddha. So Buddha was very familiar with this teaching and tried contemplating it himself, and tried to put aside all the things that he'd heard about in his time and culture about this Atman, about this true self, and said, just experientially in my own practice, through deep and sustained meditation, let's check this out. Let's check out this theory that the scriptures, the Vedas, and other ancient teachings claim that there is this indestructible, essential, permanent, singular, independent self at the core of my being. Let's check this out. And hit Buddha's discovery upon checking this out, upon looking for such a self. And we could say this is the study of the self that Dogen's talking about. To study, investigate Buddha Dharma is to investigate this self. Study this self. This was Buddha's practice. And upon investigating carefully, Buddha discovered that there isn't such a thing. He couldn't find one. But it's not like he just kind of looked around for a while in his meditation, looked into the mind and said, well, I don't see anything like that. And then said, well, then there must not be one. It was a very careful and thorough investigation. Because the self that the pre-Buddhist teachings proclaimed is not something that we can just immediately like identify, like, oh, here it is, the core me at the center here, the indestructible self. Here it is. Got a good look at it here. Nice thing. Glowing jewel in the center of my heart. We can't really see it like that, even they say. So, is it just that the Buddha looked for and didn't see it right away and said, well, I don't see anything like that? It doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be through actual investigation of his experience from different angles, he came to see how, even if there was something there that I couldn't see, it couldn't be the case. Not only do I not see it, but I know that there couldn't be such a thing, such an independent, singular, permanent essence of me. And this might be a little challenging here, so you can try to pay attention to this way that he saw this. I'll try to put it as simply as possible. Basically, he's like, well, what do we have in our experience here? What are we experiencing as our life? And the sense of me, when in our kind of everyday sense of me, like when a strong emotion comes up or somebody says, like, how dare you do that? We feel like the sense of me contracting, this me, our core sense of self. He says, well, let's see what that is. That's our experience of a self. So, what is our experience involve? Briefly, we could say it's this body and mind. We experience this body and experience this mind, both of which are highly complex events. Mind involves feelings and perceptions and all our karmic patterns, all our personality traits and tendencies and preferences and sensory experience. Uh, And then this body also, as we could say, is the sensory experiences is of our eyes and ears, tongue and touch, sense is a kind of like our bodily experience. So this I, who I really am, if all we have to go on is our experience, what is this self in relation to this body and mind experience? Because if there is a truly existent, independent self, it must be, this is one way the Buddha maybe looked at this, it must be either the same as our body and mind experience, or something completely different than our body and mind experience. This singular, independent, permanent I. Since it's singular, permanent, and independent, it can't just be like something that's in relationship to the body and mind, dependent on the body and mind. It can't be something dependent on the body and mind if it's independent. But if it's independent, it could be exactly the same as the body and mind, or completely separate from the body and mind. In other words, if it's independent, it has to be either identical to our experience or completely separate from. Those are the two possibilities. It can't be like some mix of like interdependent kind of mix with the body and mind, because then it wouldn't be independent and singular and permanent anymore. So then, you know, again, this might take, if you haven't heard this kind of thing before, it might take some contemplating this type of thinking to see if that seems true, that if there's an independent self, it must be one of these two possibilities, either identical to body and mind or completely separate from body and mind. It's kind of like two sort of like extreme views, but that's how independent things are, is they're kind of extreme. Interdependent things are not extreme. Interdependent things are like just the actual way things are appearing. So then, if we can conclude that if there's an independent self, it must be either the same as body and mind or completely separate from body and mind, then we can start looking. We can try both these options out. So first, let's try out, well, let's see if the self is the same as body and mind. If this independent, unchanging self is exactly the same as our body and mind experience. Often it feels like that's who it is. Like we feel like who I am. There's like, for example, a sense of a permanent me might be like from, you know, who we were last year up to now. Go back to even when we were born up to right now. It seems like there's some continuity of me from that time up to now. That's like a kind of permanent, a sense of a permanent self. And is that the same as this body and mind? We can pretty quickly see that, well, it can't really be. If there's something permanent there, this body and mind are constantly changing. They're completely impermanent. Like the body we had last year is not the same body as this year. So therefore, this body can't be an unchanging, independent self. And the mind, too, is like we had a, last year's mind was different than this year's. Last moment's mind was different, but that's maybe harder to see. But surely the mind of us when we were 5 years old is quite different from now. Now, we might feel that Well, isn't there, though, some consciousness that actually continues, that's the same consciousness from when we were 5 years old or when we were born, that's come down to right now? I think that's the hardest sticking point here. But if we look deeply into our consciousness or awareness of what's happening, our mental consciousness, that actually that's a moment-to-moment thing that is in itself dependent on objects of consciousness, and that it's not actually some permanent, independent entity either. Consciousness is actually arising and ceasing, and it arises dependent on the objects of consciousness. Like, I'm aware of this room right now. My consciousness that's aware of the room is dependent on the mental object of the room, or the Jikoji Zendo, and the colors and sounds of this is such a room. If there weren't such an object, the consciousness wouldn't arise. That might take some investigation too, to see how that makes sense. So this self, this independent, permanent, ongoing self, is not the same as this consciousness or any other aspect of mind. It's not this. It's not really our personality, because that changes all the time. We actually have a little bit of a different personality since we were 5 years old, right? It evolves. It's constantly changing. So body and mind are constantly changing. Our body and mind experience is arising and ceasing, dependent on a bunch of different conditions. It's an interdependently arising thing. So this independent, permanent, singular self is not the same as the interdependent, impermanent, non-singular body and mind experience. So then if we go back to the original premise that, well, if there is this independent self, it must be the same as or different than the body and mind. Okay, it's not the same as the body and mind. This essential self can't be the same as this body and mind. So therefore, if it exists, then it must be different than, completely separate than body and mind. So then let's check out that option. And that might be closer to this pre-Buddhist teaching of the Atman. It's like, well, that self is not this body and mind. The Vedas would say, the old Vedic teachings. It's something independent of body and mind. So then we say, okay, if the self is completely separate, unconnected to body and mind, then how do we know it? Everything we know through this mind and consciousness and our experience of body and mind. So if there were theoretically some self completely independent and unknowable, unreachable by body and mind, then why even bother mentioning it, you know? If we can have no experience of it, you know, not only we could say, well, maybe we're not experiencing it now, but we could experience it. We could experience it through this body and mind. Well, as soon as we know it, experience it through this body and mind, then it's dependent on the body and mind again. Can you follow that? It's a little, like, unusual to kind of think this way. You know, independent means it has no connection to our experience at all, to our body and mind experience. If there were this core essential self that's completely independent of our experience, we have no relationship to it. We have no experience of it. And part of, I think, what the Buddha was saying here is, well, even if there were such a thing as this mysterious, ethereal Atman that we have no experience of, what about this sense of me? That's what I'm interested in. Because I feel like actually when I'm not content with what's happening, that's when this sense of like this me is really strongly operating. like when somebody really insults us, attacks us, and or praises us, that the I gets, the me, sense of me gets inflated and we feel good, like, yeah, I'm really, kind of like shores up our like sense of the independent self. Cool, it's nice and strong and here and me. So that's not really like discontent. We feel good, but it's very flimsy, right? Because then the next person comes along and says, you idiot. And that same sense, it goes, and just shrivels up. And now we feel deflated. And we feel like it's me, right? I think this is an important point, is we don't just feel like they insulted my body and mind experience. That's not so bad, right? If it's just a constantly changing body and mind experience, that doesn't really mind being insulted, I don't think. Like, your body's too big or too small, and your mind's too dull or too sharp or something. If it's just body and mind, it'd just be like, oh, that's interesting. Another body and mind thinks that about this body and mind. Interesting. And we're just interested or not interested. But it's like we don't feel that sharp sense of insult. Like, not, they didn't just insult this body and mind, they insulted me. They're poking at me, at this little core essence of meanness. That's the one that, when we feel like hurt, it's the, you know, we could say our body mind experience, our emotional aspect of mind is hurt, but isn't the sense of me actually like kind of we feel like something's poking at the core me, at my very identity, at least sometimes. And the Buddha's Buddha says that sense of the true me is something like something like this Atman. Maybe if we don't even, maybe they're two different things. I don't know enough about the, you know, pre-Buddhist thought. They might say that actually this Atman is this kind of spiritual true self that that actually doesn't feel insulted. Our true core me doesn't actually feel insulted. But it's still an independent so-called self. And then we could say there's this other one that feels insulted, that's also another version of an independent core essential self, who I am. But in both cases, whether there's these different versions of the independent, singular, permanent self, in both cases, if there were such a thing, it would have to be the same as body and mind, or completely separate from body and mind. And if it was the same as body and mind are rising and ceasing moment to moment, and then the self would have to arise and cease moment to moment. So that can't be the case. If we're saying, well, maybe the self does arise and cease every moment, fine, but then we're not talking about the unceasing, permanent self anymore. So back to this issue of, well, does it exist then completely independent, separate from the body and mind? If there was this kind of spiritual Atman, maybe we'd say that is completely outside the body and mind. The body and mind can't experience it. We just know it's so because the Vedas say so. But if it's anything that we can ever experience, then we have a problem. Because the way we experience everything is through this constantly changing body and mind. Therefore, suddenly that core independent self is now dependent on our body-mind experience. So again, this kind of thing sounds really weird and hard to follow. It's the kind of thing you might have to like contemplate for a while. But this is the gist of the kind of reasoning that if there's an independent self, it must be the same as body and mind, and it must be different. And you look, could it be the same? No, it can't be the same. There's problems with that. Could it be completely different and unrelated? No, it can't be. There's problems with that. Therefore, these are the only two possibilities for an independent self. Therefore, there can't be such a thing. There can't be such a thing. So not only, this is what I mean by the Buddha looked and said, I don't see anything, so there must not be. He actually like kind of proved, or kind of like deduced, you could say, that there can't be such a thing. Not only do I not see it, but if I could see it, or experience it, it couldn't exist in one of these two ways, therefore it can't exist. So then, what about this me that feels insulted? What is that then? It seems like it's something independent of my body and mind. It seems like we're the same person as we were 10 years ago. But it can't be the case. There can't be such a one. So then what is this experience of this one who is the same, seems to be the same as 10 years ago, or yesterday, or an hour ago? Doesn't it truly feel as if we're the same person we were a minute ago, at least? So, it's like the Buddha concluded, well, it must just be an illusion. This one that seems to be the traveling through our life, me, the me that gets wounded and insulted at the core of our experience, that beyond this body and mind, you know, we could say like the owner of this body and mind experience, that's the me that has a body, my body, the me that has this body, my mind, you know, the me that owns this mind, that might not feel like, well, it's not really like there's me that's the owner of the mind, but don't we actually think this way? And the one that gets insulted, the one that feels insulted, doesn't that feel like that's me that's having this experience? The experience doesn't mind, but the me that's having the experience kind of owns my experience. That me minds being insulted. And that sense of me, the Buddha proposed, is the very source of all our problems and the very source of suffering and discontent. That there's somebody here at the core that's insultable and praiseable and kind of fragile, actually. Even though we sometimes feel like it's indestructible, if it's permanent, ongoing, it must be indestructible. And yet it's also, isn't it very like, if we're really indestructible, why does it feel so fragile when it's insulted? So, could it be that this sense of me at the core, this essence of me-ness, is actually like an illusion created by this mind and body, could maybe say. It's a very convenient way to just like locate the center of our experience and talk about and talking about ourself. It helps to just use this convenient term of, say, me. Because it's easier to say, like, you know, I'd like to have some tea now. Instead of saying, this body-mind experience, we'd like to have some tea now. It just takes longer to say it. So let's just, like, simplify it and just say, I would like to have it. This is a little story of, like, maybe how this originated. This I thing originated maybe from language. Just to simplify when we're talking to others, I'd like to have a cup of tea now. It means this body-mind experience, we'd like to have a cup of tea. But we kept saying I over and over again to the point where we started believing that there was something other than the body-mind experience that wanted to have a cup of tea. I say slowly, like over the course of evolution. We started to believe more and more that there was somebody at the core of the body-mind experience that really wants to have tea. And And maybe if I don't get the tea, maybe I will be really hurt, actually. Not only will the body-mind experience be a thirsty experience or something like that, but I might feel insulted that I didn't get the tea that I deserve, or something like that. All kinds of stories of me and tea. Could it be that that sense of self is just it's a convenient way of talking about our constantly changing body and mind experience? See, I just did it right there, so habitually. I said our conscious body mind experience, right? My conscious body mind experience. It's a convenient way of talking about my body mind experience, but I'm putting a self onto it linguistically, through language. I'm saying it's my body mind experience, but whose, you know? It's just a body-mind experience. It's not really mine. It's not really yours. But we conveniently say that and think it and then start to believe that there's somebody who's having this body-mind experience. And to see this, you know, through maybe we say studying self, is to forget the self, Dogen says, by investigating in these various ways that might be sound confusing that I'm bringing up, is one form of studying the self. If it, you know, I think it has to involve some sort of conceptual investigation. Maybe it doesn't have to be as conceptual as I'm bringing up now, but in Zazen we have to really investigate. Who is this? Who's sitting here? We have to come to the conclusion at some point that there isn't anybody at the core. And then that's this great freedom to see that. And we might be listening to this and have heard this kind of thing before and feel like, yeah, I'm down with that. I get it. And in fact, that's why I'm here and why I keep coming back and practicing the Buddha Dharma, because I trust that there's this great freedom at the core of this practice in seeing that there's really nobody to hold on to at the center here. I kind of know that, and I see it. So you could say that's one important aspect of the practice, is just coming to forget the self for a moment, forget the belief in a self. But then there's the matter of living it. So we have this Zen story of some monk in old China came to some teacher, and I don't remember their names at the moment, but the teacher said something like, "Oh, where are you from?" And the monk said, I'm from Chang'an, the capital. I'm from Washington, D.C., the capital of the country. And the teacher said, "Oh, I've heard that it's really noisy in the capital city." Maybe kind of like, as they often would play in these stories, saying you know, are you kind of noisy, you capital person? And this monk said, "Well, my province is peaceful. My realm is peaceful. I might be from the noisy capital, but the realm I live in right now is peaceful." Yeah. And to tie that into this no independent self, you could say, that's where the peace comes from. I realize that there's nobody abiding at the center of the noisy capital, so that even the noisy capital can be very, very peaceful when there's nobody at the center. There can be all kinds of stuff happening in the capital, people walking all around the streets and rushing here and there, but it's a very peaceful realm if there's nobody to be bothered and stressed by all this stuff happening around oneself. My province is peaceful. And the teacher said, well, did you get that from some teacher or from like the sutras, from some scriptures? And the monk said, I didn't get it from any teacher or from any scripture. That's kind of like the Buddha actually got this insight. He didn't get it from the Vedas because it wasn't there. The Vedas said there is something at the core. So the Buddha didn't get that insight from the scriptures, and he didn't get it from any particular teacher either. He discovered it through his own study of the self, his own investigation of the self, became his forgetting of the self. So this monk said, I didn't get it through, hearing this from some teacher or from some scripture. And the teacher says, well, many people don't read scriptures and don't ask teachers about this. Why don't they get it? Isn't that a great question? It's like, I got this peacefulness, not from any teacher or from any scripture. And the teacher says, well, many people, don't investigate the scriptures or ask Dharma teachers about these things, just like you didn't get it from these people, so why don't they get it? If you got it not from them, why do all these other people not get it not from them? And the monk says, I don't say that they don't get it, actually. It's just that they don't agree to take it up. And we could say, this maybe refers to people having some insight, or maybe this insight is actually so simple. People come upon it all the time, that there's nobody here at the core, when we're just immersed in some activity, we're just, there's nobody who's worrying about what's happening at that time. We're just the activity of body and mind that's happening. Many people maybe get this. And we can hear in this talk, yeah, I get it. There's nobody at the core. Totally cool. I get it. But are we peaceful all the time? I could say, we get it, but do we agree to take it up? What is taking it up? So it's not just a matter of like having some insight, actually. It's important to understand how they're, and more deeply. I think it's a long, maybe lifetime of investigation of how, what does this mean? What does no self mean in Buddha Dharma? But even clarifying that more and more deeply and forgetting the self, how do we take it up in a moment-to-moment way in our daily life, and where we're having to make decisions all day long, and every decision is either going to be based on supporting the belief in the independent self, or a decision that's like in accord with no independent self, a decision that's just in accord with the body and mind experience of the moment, and arising with a whole bunch of other bodies and minds in this planet together, with no core self at the center of any of them. And so, how are we going to like harmonize this whole, all these bodies and minds that are like happy and suffering and coming and going? How do we decide what's in accord with no independent self versus let's come from the view of supporting the self first? That's one way, I would say, of looking at taking it up. Not just having an insight, but taking it up moment to moment, day to day. And just to close with one huge topic of an area where we take it up or don't take it up in relation to this world that's having a huge effect on this world is consumerism. As we're a total consumer culture, right? So, and we could say this whole thing of like our consumer world that from a kind of environmental perspective is kind of destroying the planet. We can pretty much agree, right? That, but not only environmentally, but you could say worse. Most wars around the world are based on material possessiveness, coming from a view of an independent self. It's a big statement, I know, but like, it's not true. I mean, if we start to look at like all the kind of practical material problems in this world, aren't they come from people thinking that I'm here and I need this first and foremost, and because of me here needs this plastic wrapped hamburger. That's the most important thing for this self right now. This body and mind actually really doesn't need a plastic wrapped hamburger. Right? It's probably not so good for this body and mind. And for all the other bodies and minds around, including the cow that it came from, and the huge garbage dump of plastic where this plastic's going. There's probably no such thing as a plastic wrapped hamburger, actually. But, you know, these are maybe two of the main... Plastic wrapping and hamburgers are maybe two of the things that an independent self thinks it needs that is actually causing a lot of trouble in the world. Just to combine them. And isn't it kind of like based on the view of that there's somebody here who would be really happy to have this plastic wrapped hamburger? It's so convenient. You know, it's so convenient for me. You could say it's convenient for this body and mind too, but the body and mind can go along with convenience and inconvenience. That's just dependently arising stuff. But there's this me that gets concerned about like most convenient and best, and that I must come first. So this is a huge topic. There's a little bit about the independent self, seeing into it, studying it, forgetting it, and then taking up the seeing in our decisions, our moment to moment decisions every day, constant stream of decisions. Are they coming from what we know is true, if we've clarified this no independent self, or are they like, are we reverting back to that? When it comes down to actually making a decision, do we come back to the sense of the independent self? So maybe just like a minute or two if anyone has any questions.
You made a premise that in order for an independent self to exist, it must either be the body-mind or separate from the body-mind.
Yeah.
I didn't quite follow that.
Yeah,
it's just argument. Why can't it exist like 2 inches behind the eyeballs?
Oh, well, 2 inches behind the eyeballs. Yeah, so that's a good point, actually. That, completely the same as or separate then. Then there's different combinations of the more subtle aspects of those two polarities. And one would be, good point, because this is often how we think that, like, there's the I is the, for example, the owner of the body and mind. Isn't that neither one of those two? The I is the owner of body and mind. The self possesses body and mind. We often say that too, like, this is my body and mind. We feel like there's an I that has a body and mind. And is that one of those two? And then we say, actually, if we look more deeply, we see that it does fall into one of those two still. Either the I possesses the body and mind in a way that it's not separate. Like, for example, a tree possesses its core. In that way, it's actually not separate. Or we say that it's like a person possesses a car, then actually the person is separate from the car. So you can have either one of those views. But the I that possesses the body and mind is either an I that's slightly separate from the body and mind that possesses it, or it's kind of like it possesses it from like within it. Or, you know, it surrounds it, but it's still slightly separate. Or you could say, yeah, that's the I that's in the body and mind. There's a self that's in our body-mind experience, like 2 inches behind the eyeballs. In that view, it'd still be like this. There's a separation between that core glowing peanut behind the eyeballs and the rest of the body and mind. It's like it's contained within, but it's still separate. Like, and the classical examples are like soup in a bowl. Soup's in the bowl, but you can still, it's a separate thing. It's the bowl that contains it is separate from the soup. So we might feel like without first looking, oh, the soup and bowl combination, it's this one big thing, but actually the self could be like a container that holds the body and mind, or vice versa. The body and mind could be like a container that holds the self. In either case, logically, they're like slightly separate things still. It gets pretty conceptual when you kind of do these reasonings. So I think it's a beautiful way to practice is actually investigating these more and more closely, but it has to keep being brought into our actual experience. Like we can get the soup in the bowl metaphor, but then we have to like relate that back to our body, mind, and self experience. But we don't talk about in Zen doing this kind of thing too much, but I recommend it if you have such a mind and some spare time in Zazen sometime. Like you don't have some spare time in Zazen. You can take these things up. Thank you. We dedicate any positive energy arising from this study and forgetting today to the freedom of all beings from discontent. May they all contemplate, investigate the self more and more and be freed from any fixed notions about it.